Viewers, listeners, welcome to another edition of Blighty Talks Bricks. My guest today is someone that reached out to us a few weeks back, so I don't know her. We have had a 15-minute conversation on the telephone, and what I picked up from that conversation was someone that has got an amazing work ethic, very, very smart, switched on, really genuine, and so I'm super excited. I'm really looking forward to today's podcast. Bijanay, welcome to Blighty Talks Bricks.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm really well. Before I get into the detail and bits and pieces, I saw a little post on Instagram the other day. I understand you've got some amazing news.
Yes, just
congratulations on your engagement.
Thank you so much.
And I also, from looking behind you, you didn't actually do it where we're sitting in this studio in East London. You did it in a very nice place.
I did, yes. We were in Santorini, so that was lovely.
And you had a lovely time?
I had a lovely break. It was a nice break from work.
Brilliant. Well, I wish you well going forward.
Thank you.
You've got your own boutique interior design business, AJ. You're South London based.
Yeah.
You got your passport to come over to East London
Born
today.
Born and bred, I did. Got it in my pocket.
So we always have this thing with Londoners, don't we, North and South? It's interesting. When I looked at some of the things about you, when I did a little bit of research, one of the things that struck me was this anti-trend ethos. Mm. Tell me why. Tell me how that... I loved it, by the way. I really liked the fact that you're not following.
Yeah.
Is the way I pick that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I love that interpretation of it. I think ultimately for us, an anti-trend ethos is really just pushing our clients to allow us to develop homes for them that feel like them, that don't feel like Instagram or Pinterest. And I think that's a really important movement nowadays when it comes to development of homes, just for us to really find a space that feels authentically us. And I think that's something that we really like to centralize our studio around.
Do you find that people, because interior design, it's a property, it's a strange thing. I've been around interior design for many years.
Yeah.
Do you find that the clients come to you because you've got that ethos, or is it they come to you and they didn't know that you had that sort of, we're going to do it different?
Yeah, I think like any business, you know, over time, I've been running this business for 3 years. I've been in the industry for 10. And I think it takes some time to be able to properly articulate what you're trying to do in that space. So I think it's taken us a couple of years to be able to establish ourselves in that space and in doing things a little bit differently. You know, everybody has to start from the same place. Yep. But I think now I like to think that clients do approach me because they connect with me and they connect with what I represent. And I think if you know me for 5 minutes or 5 years, you kind of know that that's quite a central value to me, that everybody should be unique and feel that they have the permission to express themselves.
How did you said you've been in it for 10 years. How did you get into property?
Yeah. So I was fairly academic, I guess, traditionally.
You have a big difference there.
We talked a bit about that. But I was fairly academic. I did well in school. I did well in exams. I find it quite easy to hyper-focus on tasks. So I was quite good at exams, generally speaking. Didn't love school, but didn't find it difficult. And I decided that because I loved literature and I loved theatre and the arts, I wanted to study English literature. And I got into a really good university and I thought that that was what I wanted to do. And there was so much pressure at 18 years old to make a lifelong decision. And there's so much pressure. And I don't really think you know most of the time who you want to be at 18.
I'm glad you said that because I'm 60 and I still don't know.
Yeah, and that's what life's about because we change. But when I was 18, you know, being in the spaces, I had two parents that did both go to university. They were both linguists, are both linguists, and I was encouraged to. I wasn't pushed to, but I was encouraged that that's a nice natural next step that I had the privilege of being able to make the decision about. So I did go to university and I did a year and I absolutely hated it.
Do you know what? I thought you were going to say you absolutely loved it.
I absolutely hated it. I loved reading the books. I loved learning about medieval literature. And I found it so interesting understanding the historical context behind literature and the arts. But I am an introvert. I'm quite a big introvert, and I found it, when it came to the social element of university, I found it entirely overwhelming. And I just, I was
really
very unhappy. Yeah.
But you've got this really outgoing personality. You're obviously very confident. Mm-hmm. Is that something that's come since you were 18?
I think I've always been confident, and I think there's often a misconception that confidence means you're not an introvert. But you know, being an introvert just
interesting. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, being an introvert really means that it takes energy from you to be in certain social scenarios. So for me, something like this is quite easy. A one-on-one chat is comfortable for me, where I don't have to raise my voice to be heard. I love going for a coffee with friends or having a drink with friends. But as soon as you put me in a scenario where I have a larger dinner of 10 people, that I find quite draining.
Do you?
I do. And obviously university is very much about asserting yourself and finding your clique and going out. You have to be sociable. You cannot stay in your room. And I did. So.
Yeah. And so the end of the first year comes,
yeah,
and you're hating it.
Yeah.
By the sounds of it, no peer pressure at home.
No peer pressure at home.
So you made a decision then?
So I'm somebody who is very decisive. I find it a really nice tool to navigate life, to be decisive, because I think the way that I look at things is when I make a decision, if it goes completely wrong, I'm okay with it. And if it goes really well, I'm okay with it. And I think that's the only way you can be confident in life. You just have to be confidently, constantly making mistakes. And so when I committed to university, I'd made my decision. I would go, it would be 3 years. It wouldn't necessarily be life-changing if I didn't use that degree, but it was a decision that I'd made. And I was incredibly unhappy. I really didn't enjoy it. I didn't find my clique, if you will. I just didn't connect with many people in that space. I didn't want to go to all of the student events and things like that. So I kind of isolated myself a bit, I would say. And when I came home after doing my first year exams, I'd done really well. I felt quite confident. I'd studied. I'd enjoyed the course. I loved going to the lectures. Yeah. And my mum actually pulled me to the side. And it's a story I tell often because I really credit her for this as a mother. But she pulled me to the side. And she said, B, you don't seem very happy. Why? And I said, leave me alone. I've made my decision. I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, you fought against that in the beginning. That's interesting, isn't it?
I really had made my decision. And I
committed in your mind for 3 years. You wasn't enjoying it. You'd sort of made your bet. I'm going to lay on it kind of thing. Yeah. Even though you knew it wasn't good for you.
It wasn't right for me.
But mum spotted that.
She knows me. You know, my mum predominantly brought me up. And she said to me, you don't seem happy. Sit down and talk to me about it. And we had a really life-changing conversation for me, not just because it ended in me leaving university, but also just because it taught me a lot about life, that you can change your mind. So that was a really important moment in my life. And she sat me down, and all of the things that I thought I was completely tied to, like having put a deposit down for my house the next year with my flatmates, having bought all of my books on Amazon for the next term, you know, having signed into all of these classes with these tutors, she helped me find an escape route out of all of those decisions. And she, one by one, we sat down and found a way out. So,
well, she sounds like an amazing mum.
Yeah.
Had you always had those growing up? Had you always had those sort of one-to-one conversations? Just generally, not necessarily about bad things.
Yeah, but I think we did. We've always had a close relationship, and I've always been very honest with her. She was very much, her parenting style was for us to have honest conversations. I've been encouraged to do that, and it very much shows in my personality because I'm very much a black and white, honest person. I like having difficult conversations. I think it's important.
You want to come and work in my business?
I think it's very important because I think, you know, there's a difference between keeping peace and making peace. And I think that sometimes you can be perceived to be combative or argumentative when you're somebody who confronts or has difficult conversations more frequently than the average person. But actually, the way that I see it is that that's making peace. Like, sometimes you need to correct things and discuss mm-hmm. things for it to be resolved. So she's taught me that. And that was really the first moment in my memory will stay with me in terms of a really important one-to-one conversation, because she changed the course of the decisions that I made subsequently.
And have you got brothers and sisters?
So I'm an only child, but my life changed quite dramatically when my parents divorced. So I was about 7, and it was just me, and I was the princess, still am. But, you know, my mum remarried, and she met my stepfather, and that was a whirlwind experience for me because he had 5 children.
5, wow.
One of which is my stepsister, who has cerebral palsy.
Okay.
So what that meant is that our home was adapted for her disability. So we had double width doors. We had through floor lift to her room. We had all of these things that I'd never experienced or thought about before, because it's a privilege to not have to think about disability.
Absolutely.
And that was the first time that I'd kind of experienced, you know, a molded living situation to accommodate that. So I moved in and it was a complete whirlwind. And yeah, that was also quite shaping in my life, I would say.
And you were 7 then?
So I was about 11 when I moved in.
Okay.
So I remember I'd moved in and then I started secondary school.
And did you have to move location to do that?
Yeah. So not too far. I've always been a South London girl. But I moved into the council house that they were living in. So it was a large 3-storey council house that was, like I say, accommodating for her disability.
And the relationship you've got with your siblings, good?
It's interesting because I think blended families are always complex. And I was always the princess. So moving in was difficult because I still had a relationship and have a great relationship with my father, which has grown over the years.
Yeah.
But that wasn't always so easy to accept my stepfather as like an authoritative role in my life.
Yeah.
And it took a while for me to accept him as a parental role. And I think it was when I went to university and he supported me in transitioning to that space and also supported me on my way out that I really started to grow a deep respect for him. And unfortunately, he passed away 5 years ago.
Okay, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, so we had actually grown quite close. Yeah. And that was a great lesson in, you know, how relationships and, again, how things can change.
Well, I've got some similar things there. I'm an only child.
Yeah.
My parents did stay together, although I always say they bloody well shouldn't. They were a nightmare. But like you, I was loved.
Yeah.
We had no money, but I was loved. Mm-hmm. It gave me great confidence. So I understand the only child bit.
Yeah.
And I always say to people, we are different.
Yes.
And I'm now remarried. And so I have a blended family. My blended kids were amazing. And they took to my son so well. Mm. And I always say this to people. So, you know, I've got 4 kids in total. Kids, they're adults. The only one that they don't like is me, all of them together. And that includes the dog. Even the dog don't like me. So, but it is difficult.
Yeah.
And it's also difficult. And you know, you've made the remark there that, you know, it's quite tough to be a stepdad or a stepmum, especially if you've still got relationships with the father or mother that the scenario creates.
Of course.
And it's not an easy role.
Mm.
And I try... And I've always worked on the basis, I'm not your dad, I don't want to be your dad, but maybe I can be your friend.
Yeah.
And that sounds as though that you went on that journey.
Definitely. That sounds exactly like my stepfather. You know, it took a while, and it's difficult, but...
And you still see dad now?
I'm really close with my dad.
And that's good.
I always say, when people ask me about my father, I always say we have a very adult relationship, which means that, not that it's very formal and... you know, we have such a close relationship, very much daddy-daughter, very much a daddy's girl. But what I mean by an adult relationship is that, you know, it's grown over time with respect and boundaries and strengthening through challenges as an adult, because obviously we didn't live together after the divorce. So there's been a lot of learning and relearning that's been involved in that relationship. And yeah, I love my dad. I'm so, so, so close to my dad.
And a great mum, great dad.
Yeah.
So, you know, your world is got a lot of positivity there.
Mm-hmm.
So you're at uni. You realise it's not for you. Mum's been an angel.
Yeah.
Mum's sorted, taken a lot of challenges away.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to bed that night. You've dealt with your deposit. You've dealt with your books that are coming on Amazon. You wake up in the morning and then what do you decide?
I wake up in the morning. I go down for breakfast and she says, well, what are we doing then? Go and figure it out. So there was not much buffer period, because my mum was, again, another great lesson for me, because she didn't kind of coddle me in that moment. It was very much, I will support you, I will help you see your options, but you need to act and get off your bum and go and make a decision. So that's, I think, where my personality has been formed. Like, that was a very forming moment for me. But I very much remember her having that conversation with me and saying, look, you are going to be 19 years old. You need to move out. You need to start a career and decide what your next option is, because you've just quit the last one. So that was... I think the motivation I needed, and I remember very much choosing to move into this space. So I didn't fall into it, although I did have experiences in the space, in both the fashion space and the design and the styling spaces, before university, just, you know, in teenage work experience and things that I was exploring as a curious teenager. I really didn't know that I wanted to go into interior design, but in looking at all of my options and all of my experiences, it was the only thing that really reached out to me that I think satisfied my creativity, that I wanted to be able to have at the core of my career.
Was it clothing before interiors, or was it just interiors?
So before I went to university, I was a very active teenager. I loved experiences. I've always worked really hard. I've never been a lazy person. And I would obviously do the standard school experience, work experience that we are forced to do. That was just a retail, you know, work right. experience slot. But after that, I also took on some more internships, so I could learn a little bit more about the space and figure out what I wanted to do, because I did feel at 16 that my friends knew what they wanted to do.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. And to be honest, a lot of them did go into those spaces. But I had a friend who wanted to be a fashion designer, and I had a friend who wanted to be a nurse, and one who wanted to be a psychologist. And they actually are all subsequently in those spaces. And I had absolutely no idea at 16. I didn't have a dream job at 16. So I tested things out. I like to put myself in situations that challenge me. So I worked for... an ethical fashion magazine in the editorial department, and I was kind of assisting the editor of that magazine, and that was an interesting experience because I learned about sustainability in the spaces that we work in. And then after that, I thought maybe I want to go into fashion. So I reached out to a fashion stylist and I asked to assist her. And whenever I had time off school or college, I would assist her. And, you know, she would send me with a suitcase around London and I'd pick up from all these boutique fashion brands and I'd bring it to set. But I remember what I found most interesting was that when we got to these spaces that she had sort out, they would be maybe old homes or manors or just interesting spaces that we were going to have these photo shoots in, and I was much more invested and interested in the space itself
than the merchandise.
Yeah. So that I think was the first peg in my mind where I noticed my interest in design and spatial styling, and I think that moment came back to me when I went upstairs and figured out what I wanted to go into.
So when did you start your business?
So at that point I decided interior design, and I was looking at how to get into the space, and every resource, every blog, every article I read told me I needed a degree, and I just quit mine. So I remember thinking, how do I get into this space? I don't know anyone. I'm not from a background where I was around fancy homes or I knew any interior stylists or designers. That is not my background at all. I had no idea where to start. So what I decided to do was start another degree. And I knew I had to work because I'd been told I should soon move out. So I started a degree at KLC School of Design in Chelsea, which is a really great university.
Day course?
It was actually an evening course. So I didn't sleep very much and I worked in the day and I moved out. And at first, I had a bit of a sales background, as most teenagers do, working in retail. So I found a bit of a segue into the space, a bit of a shortcut, which was kitchen design, because most kitchen designers are actually sales designers. And so I went to my manager at Magnet and I said, I don't know how to measure a room, but I am starting this degree, so I'll know how to measure a room in a couple of weeks. Will you give me a job I can sell? And she took me to my first property and taught me how to measure a room.
Did she?
And I slowly kind of built my career from there. And after a few years of working in the industry in different companies, I was made redundant just after I'd bought my first apartment, just after lockdown.
Nice timing.
Just after lockdown.
Nice timing.
So I'd started a renovation on this apartment, and then the government announced that everything was shut and my contractors wouldn't come back, and I just got made redundant. So I felt that same panic after I'd left university of what am I going to do? Am I going to go back and try and find a job when I don't feel like I belong in these spaces and I don't think I have the stamina to deal with 20 interviews and insert myself into these studios that don't really fit me, or do I just go for it and start a business? So that was kind of the start of AJ.
Was it?
Yeah.
That's very brave.
Yeah.
It's very brave. Some would say foolish.
Yeah.
But I agree with your sentiments, you know. Yeah. I've made mistakes. I've fallen over many times. Mm. And you do have to get up.
Yeah.
And that's it. Especially if you've got a work ethic and you want things, something that I personally believe is seriously lacking in this country at the moment.
Yeah.
So you've been brave. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing you've mentioned 3 years. Has it been tough?
It's been unbelievably tough, I think. Running a business is just all-consuming. Starting a business from the ground without any support is very, very hard. I think, you know, even though I'd worked in the industry for 7 years before that, working for different studios and design and build companies, I knew how to do it because I often worked for small companies and they'd often leave me in charge of things. So I knew how to run a business and I knew what it took. And that's kind of what gave me the confidence to take the step, because I thought, if he's left me with his business and gone on holiday for 2 months, then I can do it myself.
2 months?
Yeah, I had a manager.
Can I go and work there?
Well, I had a manager who... it was a small design and build company, and they used to go away for several weeks every year, and I used to manage everything. So he would go and barely be contactable, really. And I think that's what gave me the confidence, because when you get put in that position and you're running someone else's business, there's no reason why you can't do it for yourself.
And so that gave you the confidence.
Yeah.
You being a lady,
mm-hmm.
a female,
mm-hmm.
is that, and I know, I think interior, that the interior designers I've dealt with over the years have been in the main female.
Yeah.
Was that a challenge for you?
Yeah, it's a challenge.
And you look very young.
Yes.
And I know you are young, but was that a challenge?
Yes. I think I've always been the youngest in my space as well. And most of the very established interior designers are probably late 30s to...
Dreadful age.
Late 30s to late 50s, generally, when they become established enough to take on some of the size projects that I do. But I've kind of just always pushed myself to the front. But I think in younger years, I did overcompensate for my age because I felt like I needed to look older or be a
I'm
bit more...
I'm going the opposite way and I can't pull it off. It's dreadful.
But just be a bit more dressed up and feel like I was... I think I've always been conscious of how I present myself because I know that it's the first thing people notice. But in my younger years, when I was like late teens, early 20s, I think I felt like I needed to establish myself a bit more to make people trust me. But that you start to let go of that as you become more experienced and you don't need to prove yourself in the same... You know, your work
speaks. You can take your work along.
You can take your work along, yeah. But you do have to compensate
at the beginning. But it had to start from somewhere.
It had to start. And I mean... The industry is predominantly male. Yes, interior designers, there's a lot of women in interior design, but the kind of work that I do, we're not talking interior decoration, just going in at the end to put the curtains up. I tend to get involved right from the architectural stage all the way through
to
the end.
So effective, like a build design aspect.
Yes. So my clients trust me with everything. So the most popular service that I do and the clients I'm closest with, it's a turnkey service. So we... are the first port of call and we are the last person to hand over the property. And that's a lot of responsibility.
I was just going to say, that is a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
But you're smiling.
Yeah.
You're obviously enjoying it.
I love it.
And business is okay?
Yeah, so last year was great. Like I think because I've been here around for 3 years now, my business, and the first year was like trying to get those first few projects because I wasn't able to bring my portfolio with me.
Yep.
From my previous company. So you very much start from the beginning. So I got, you know, a few kitchens, bathrooms, things here and there. I was chugging along. And the second year, last year, was great. I had a good year last year. I got a few big projects. It was all very exciting. Never a quiet moment. This year's been tough. So I still have three big projects from last year that are still tailing on into this year, because obviously I'm with my clients for a long time, about a year and a half.
You will be from those kind of jobs, yeah.
So, you know, there's two challenges there. The first one is the fact that, you know, you're taking on so much responsibility and there's only so many projects you can take on. So you understand, you know, delays and things.
Absolutely.
It then caps your capacity to go and take on more. And secondly, it's showing your work is really tough for me because I haven't been able to shoot anything. I was just with a client now talking about a shoot in her house, and it's a whole ordeal for us to do a photo shoot. And without the photo shoots, it's very hard for me to get that type of client
again. You need the promotion to go with it, yeah?
So that's where I'm at right now. It's like we've been doing this really, really hard work roughly for about the past year, and I haven't been able to photograph anything new since my first year of business. So I'm really looking forward to the end of this summer and just being able to shoot a few of those projects and show what we're capable of, really.
And in terms of growing your business, you want to create this environment where you've got a number of employees. Mm-hmm. And is that an aim, or is it, I want to keep it small because it's you're obviously in control of what you want to do?
So I've tested a few things out in the last year. So I brought on a colleague whom I had the intention of becoming a business partner. Yeah. And I realised that she's wonderful. I've worked with her on many different projects. She's a dear friend of mine, love her to bits. But I realised the type of clients that I get, especially because I'm the first engagement, so they are often referred to me. They see me online. I'm the first person they talk to. That's what I'm good at. And they didn't want to work with anyone else. Yeah, so when I had that moment, I had a client call me and say, "B, I love so-and-so who you've sent to me, but I want you. Can you come back? I don't want to do it like this." And I remember sitting down and thinking, that's going to dictate how this business goes. But I think I'm okay with that, because what I would love to do, I don't have an aspiration to grow a massive, soulless design studio that churns out the same work. I love, you know, having coffee with my clients, them telling me how in sync we were. Like, it's a very personal process for
me. Absolutely, especially what you're doing from beginning to end.
It's so, so personal. And I'm creating, you know, lifestyle homes for people. I'm creating homes that are changing their life because now they want to entertain, because they're creating moments and memories with their family, with their friends. It really does change their life. You know, I have clients who are actresses or in the music industry or influencers or just entrepreneurs, and they don't have a space that's just for them because they're constantly traveling, they're constantly in other people's spaces, and they do not want a home from Instagram. They want to walk in and know that they're home, and that is so important. So my goal essentially is for it to still be me. I will always centralize myself in the business, and just to grow a little bit more in terms of having more solid employees. So I have a few designers that work with me and help me with the technical stuff, because I can't sit on a laptop for 10 hours anymore because I'm too busy with the clients. It's my job to keep them happy, to be in touch with the builders, to be on site. The attention to detail comes down to experience, and I'm the most experienced person in my business at the moment. So I think my goal is to have a boutique studio, you know, have a small team of no more than 10 designers working with me, and just to be working with selective clients who really meet
people that understand your ethos,
people who
understand what your business sentiment's about,
yes,
and what your clients need.
Yeah,
I get that.
Yeah,
well, you've convinced me, and I'm not easy to convince, trust me. You've convinced me. When I have people on that are in the property world, I created a while back this magic wand, the Blighty Talks Bricks magic wand. You're in the space now, you're in the property space. If I gave you that wand and said, "Be over to you," what three things would you like to actually say, "Do you know what, this is what I'd like to bring into play, that I can influence things?"
Well,
it might only be two. You know, I had one guy that came on and he used two, and he said for the government, he'd bring back Guy Fawkes because he wanted... So it was a bit tongue-in-cheek, but so you don't have to use all three, but you've got three.
Okay. Well, the first one that comes to mind for me is homelessness. I, as somebody who spends their clients' money, I bought a toilet the other day that costs the cost as much as what somebody could spend on housing themselves in a hostel for a year. That is hard, because it's always a pull for me, because it's such a privilege. It's such a privilege for me that I get to design these spaces and be in these homes. And for my clients who get to spend that kind of money on such luxuries, such a luxury to be able to pick something that's completely bespoke and is going to make your life a luxury.
And it does make you then look back to what's going on.
Yes. So I very much, for me, the issue with homelessness is a huge thing that I'll always...
It needs to be looked at.
It needs to be looked at, and I don't know what the solution is. I try and work with charities where I can, because for me it's a real problem, especially being in this space. It very much pulls on my heart.
I get that.
So one thing I would change is that there's some kind of initiative that really...
We need to be talking about it.
We need to be thinking more.
Listen, this is going to go out in a few weeks. The election's just... This is the day after. And I think there's a big lesson to be learned for Labour and for what's left of the Conservative Party, that they didn't listen to what the people they serve.
Mm.
If you don't want to serve somebody as an MP, don't be an MP.
Right.
And they didn't. And homelessness, the housing crisis we have, which is this podcast is about.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. Mm. It is something that needs to be discussed, rather than go, oh, we've got a problem, but... NIMBYism, this, that, type of, nothing should get in the way of that.
The thing is with the housing crisis as well, the thing that perplexes me so much is that everybody talks about there being a housing shortage, but it's not just a housing shortage, it's an affordable housing shortage, because there are so many houses, but nobody can afford to live in them or buy them. That's the problem.
We've got lots of, the average age of the first-time buyer is 33, 34.
Yeah.
The average deposit in the UK is 53 grand.
Mm-hmm.
All of that doesn't work.
No.
And if people think by not building more property, that's the way of keeping prices down is wrong.
Mm.
We need to start looking at it. So I get the homeless bit.
Yeah. So that would be my first one.
Yeah, I'm on board.
I think the other thing would really tie into my anti-trend ethos. I wish we would spend less time on social media and looking at what everybody else has. And that surpasses just properties and homes and spaces. But I think there's even been times where I personally have had to pull myself back, because it's so easy for my generation to compare or to look at the next thing. You're never happy. You're never happy with what you have.
Right.
And so I love Pinterest and Instagram, and I think inspiration is wonderful. And of course, it's a great inclusive platform whereby designers worldwide can share their work. And it really is great for my business and my career and for other designers' businesses and careers. It makes my industry more diverse, which I'm very much for. But what it means is that people are never happy, and it means that people are copying. So we get a lot of designers' work being copied, literally aesthetic for aesthetic. We have all of these aesthetic categories that people feel they need to put themselves into. And so what I think we're experiencing is more beautiful spaces, more aesthetic spaces, but spaces that have the soul taken out of them.
Well, I think, we're on social media, but you're absolutely right. I think the anxiety, the emotional wellness of people is challenged, not from everyday life, which is hard enough as it is, but it is from social media that, people look on stuff. And I hear some horrendous stories of kids at school on the bullying side as well. But you're absolutely right. So I'm on board with that one. So you're doing really well. It's a pity the election was last night. We could have put you up there. You know that, don't you?
I would have been all for that.
So what's your third one?
I think I have to throw a design one in there. It's just very surface level. But one thing for me that I would change is something about the direction of design trends. Again, it kind of ties into my last one. But I feel like we should be authentic when we design and build and decorate spaces. So what I mean by that is the paneling and new builds, the kind of period property wannabe apartments that developers are building, I feel like we should be authentic to the character of the building, the history of the building. I think we should stop trying to erase things and making them what they look like online or in a magazine. I think we should really just be authentic and genuine when we're building spaces.
Well, you got my vote on that one as well, because really? I live in a house that's listed.
Yeah.
And it wobbles everywhere.
And I hope you kept some of the properties.
Oh, no, that. All of it has to be kept. Yeah. There is a cost implication, yeah. which is always the problem. But no, totally agree. And I think that, you know, part of the criticism of new build from the public in the past has been when you drive past these big developments, and it's true in some cases, yeah. they all look the same.
Yeah.
But, well, I'm going to take my wand back, because I can see I could give you another 20 wishes here. I'm going to take my wand back. You touched on some charities.
Mm.
I like to bring to people's attention, because we are in a recession as we sit here today. Hopefully the new government are going to take that by both hands and start to address those issues. But charities struggle big
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
What's the? Is there a charity or a couple of charities that are really close to your heart?
Yeah, homelessness charities. So a charity I'm working with at the moment is St Mungo's. And they're a charity in London who, they do great work, you know, providing roofs overhead and just doing so much work in the community. And what I love about working with them is they have a really great network of sponsors and supporting businesses. And, you know, we're a small business, so we can't pledge hundreds of thousands of pounds, but something that we can do is support them in creating spaces that are better for the people that live in them. So what I'm doing at the moment is I'm working with them on one of their accommodation units in South London. And we are kind of restyling the foyer area, and we are switching out some furniture. And what we're doing is, with basically no budget, trying to transform the way it feels and makes residents feel through colour. And I think that's been really fun to work on with them, because everybody deserves a space that makes them feel good.
They do.
And I think your wellness, our wellness and how we feel, is so inextricably tied to the spaces that we're in. And I think people don't realise that. I think they're becoming more aware of it after lockdown and being forced to stay at home. But it really is important that, you know, we are conscious and thoughtful in how we decorate
spaces.
Did you
think you picked up some of those values from your stepsister with cerebral palsy?
I think, yeah, a lot of my life's experiences have infiltrated and trickled into my values in this business and the things that are important to me. But I think for me, it's about, I've moved a few times, not many times, not 10 times, but those moves were all quite significant. So living in a house with my mother and my father, I remember when we left that house, for me, there was a huge sentimental attachment to the house, like the swirled carpet and, you know, the gloss tiles in the kitchen and just some of the very 90s elements of that home. And I remember the day that we were leaving, literally walking around the property trying to remember some of those elements, because for me that represented my childhood.
Yeah, I get that.
And then moving in with my mother was a whole different spatial experience, and we very much built it together. She involved me very much in going to look at some of the properties, kind of help encouraging me to imagine myself there. She tried to make it fun. She tried to make it a game to keep things lighthearted yeah. in such a heavy moment in life. And I remember that clearly too, going to IKEA after she's finished work in the evenings and, you know, picking out things together. It was very much a game of us building this life together. And then moving into this large adapted council house with all of these people and more masculine energy than I was used to. So I think all of those things have made me extremely conscious of how space makes you feel and how it kind of timestamps periods of your life.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about timestamps. Just before we sat down, I say this all the time, I said to you time would go quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I can tell that your experiences in life, and it's a very young life,
mm-hmm.
But you've got a very mature, wise head on you. I knew when we spoke on the telephone that you were going to be lovely. I get picked up on my term of using the word lovely on these podcasts, but that's purely and simply because it's factual.
Yeah.
People that know me well, I'm outspoken, I'm opinionated,
mm-hmm.
And I tend to say what I believe. But you are lovely.
Thank you.
I've really enjoyed my time with you. You know, when we sat down, I said, oh, this is just us having a chat. It feels exactly like that. I'll also say to you that when I sat down, I haven't had a great couple of days.
Mm.
but you've made me feel so much better. Wholesome. You just, I love the way, you know, I look at the young today, I look at the youth. I worry about them. I think if we can get more people like you, I don't have anything to worry about.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you.
Thank you, Bea, for your time.
Thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I look forward to keeping in touch. I'd love to come and see what your charity stuff you're doing. And if you want me to cock up a job for you, give me a call and I'll come and ruin it totally overnight. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Viewers, listeners, we come to an end of another podcast. I say it every time and I'm going to keep saying it until it changes. Another lovely human being. Time's flown. I hope you people have enjoyed it as much as I have. Take care. Stay safe. And come on, Labour. Let's not bugger this up. All the best. Bye-bye.